Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 346, recorded May the 4th, 2018, for May the 11th, 2018. Adam Ghazali. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where every week we talk to some of the brightest minds working in technology today. I am thrilled to speak to Adam Ghazali. He's a PhD, an MD at UCSF. He's a neuroscientist, an author, an inventor. He's the founder and executive director of Neuroscape and the co-founder of Achille Interactive Labs, and has long been studying a field that we, the rest of us, have just recently become very interested in, technology distraction and our brains. Last year, he published The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World, and his video game is currently in phase three trials at the FDA. Welcome, Dr. Ghazali.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, so you've been working on a therapeutic video game for about a decade now. This is not new, and I definitely want to talk about it. But I want to start with a little bit of your background. I read that you grew up watching Carl Sagan in Queens and also playing Space Invaders on your Atari. Is that where all of this began?
I suppose so. I never really put together the Atari playing with my scientific interest, but I suppose that now that I build video games as therapeutic tools, I guess that's a fair assessment. I didn't have a lot of scientific people in my life. I didn't know any doctors or scientists when I was a kid. And watching Carl Sagan and going to the Museum of Natural History was the stimulus that I had that really turned me on to this.
And how did you get specifically interested? I know your first work you did was in the brain and how what happens when we age. How did you get interested in that?
Well, actually, it was sort of just by chance when I was a graduate student in New York City. So I went to school for an MD and a PhD program. My advisor had access to a population of old animals, really, that they were interested in studying how their memory was changing. And I thought it was interesting. It was when you're 20, you don't think about doing projects on aging. But I took it up. And ever since then, I've been studying the aging brain. I switched after I did a residency in neurology. I switched over to doing research on humans and human aging, studying the brain through functional brain recordings, both MRI and EEG, to understand how our cognitive abilities change as we get older.
And so I guess your 20s was probably the best time to be doing it, since you say that now, like at age 24, it all goes downhill from there, right?
I mean, that's really the peak. It's not the peak for all of cognitive abilities. So just to be fair, a lot of our cognition does preserve throughout our lives, especially if you're looking at semantic knowledge about the world, like vocabulary, and some abilities like wisdom even improve because they are coupled with your experiences. But if you look at the fluid cognitive abilities we have, like our processing speed in general, how we resist distraction, how we switch between tasks or multitask, and even how we deploy our attention, that does decline pretty much from a peak in the early 20s.
I mean, I always think about, you know, your brain's not developed until you're 25, they say now. So now it's, I don't know how, I guess those both things are true, that some certain cognitive abilities start to deteriorate at 24, but then some things aren't even finished being built yet.
I mean, that's sort of where that statement comes from. Our brains are still myelinating, especially in the front part of our brains, and that's involved in a lot of the abilities, all the abilities that I just described. So they're peaking then, and then they're declining right after. So there's not like a long plateau that you ride out for decades and decades. That's why it's true both that it's the peak and the beginning of the decline.
The 25 is what I tell my teenagers. I have three of them, and that's my argument for not doing drugs yet.
Seems reasonable.
I think yeah. All you could say is not yet. Wait till the brain gets finished. Wait till it starts deteriorating on its own.
Then you can help it along.
So you were doing this work, and I read that you know sort of like you would give speeches to older adults explaining what happened in the brain, and it was sort of an all bad news situation, as you described it. I think maybe talking to Tim Ferriss, maybe Kevin Rose. I can't remember which one. That you know, you got to the end, and you had of this talk about all the research that you had done into what happens to the human brain, and you had all these faces looking back at you like the movie had just ended, everyone had died, and the credits rolled. So talk a little bit about what happened after you had this sort of epiphany about what to do next.
Could you repeat the question? Just cut out for a moment.
Oh, sure.
At the very end.
Talk about a little bit about what happened, why you decided to change from what you were doing, just studying the brain and its effects as you age to what you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, you really described it perfectly. I had been studying the brain for, at that point, this was 2008, over 15 years, and we had a lot of important findings from my lab about how our brains really struggle with distraction and multitasking, and a lot of that is very timely given technology's change in our lives. But it started becoming increasingly frustrating for me to report the bad news and not do anything about it. And I just didn't want to go through the rest of my career just going deeper and deeper into the details are not as good as we want them to be, when it seemed that there was so much opportunity of actually improving our function. And so that was the transition point for me, was to say, how do we use the expertise that we have, the inspiration of improving our function, not just studying it, to do something new?
And so where did the video game aspect of this come in?
Well, as physicians, we tend to reach for small molecules, what we call drugs or pharmaceuticals, whenever we have a problem, right, with our brains, whether it's attention, memory, emotional regulation, so anxiety and depression. And we know that those treatments are not great. They have lots of side effects. They're not really well personalized. Some people don't have really strong positive effects at all. And so I was trying to think about something different to do that could complement our current system and give it a boost. And the idea was really simply that we have this phenomena in our brain known as plasticity, right? The ability of our brain to modify itself in response to environmental challenges. This is the entire basis of learning. It's why education exists as a practice. It's why meditation and mindfulness have been practices for thousands of years, in that our brains will optimize itself if it's challenged appropriately. The idea was, could we use technology? This is before I actually thought of a video game in particular. Could we use technology to create interactive experiences to challenge our brains in a very targeted way to help improve them? And from that point on, the video games just flowed naturally. I was a video game player for all of my life, and I was thinking that if we're going to create an interactive experience that's targeted for someone, we want them to be deeply engaged in it, and we want them to play it for a long period of time. And so it seemed that the best way to create that type of immersion in an experience that was presented digitally was through a video game. And so that was sort of the launching off point for that idea.
And so that was 2008.
That was 2008. It actually was a dream. I know it sounds so weird to say that, but it was a dream that I had of the design of the game itself, a game that we call NeuroRacer. And so that game involves driving a car on a road and responding to signs as rapidly and accurately as you can. So the game is designed to challenge you to manage interference, both distraction and multitasking. And the hypothesis that I had, based on a lot of research that we had been doing, was that the brain networks involved in dealing with that type of interference challenge are also overlapping networks to those that you use when you attend, even in a sustained way, or that you use to hold information in mind, something we call working memory. So the idea was that if you could challenge interference resolution at a high enough level, we'll be able to lead to improvement outside of the game into other activity, other functions of the brain like attention. So that, right, that was 2008.
Okay, so you have an MD and a PhD, and you said you played video games your whole life, so lots of people out there listening to this are cheering, like, yes, I know the two things are possible. Did you see positive effects of video games in your own life as you were growing up?
I mean, except that it made me happy and it was fun. I don't think I could say that I noticed a cognitive benefit. There is research out there. You know, I have not done research on consumer available video games, but there is a large research that was another inspiration back in 2008 that sort of helped nurture this idea of using a video game as a cognitive enhancement tool. And that was a research that showed that young people, usually in these studies that played games, first-person shooter games like Call of Duty, had improved attention and distraction resistance and multitasking on tests when you brought them into the laboratory. So I don't know if they noticed those. I certainly didn't notice it from my own gameplay. But if you look in careful laboratory studies, people that play those type of video games in particular do show improvements in their cognition.
When I was young, before I had kids, I remember the big thing was, oh, violent video games are turning all our kids violent, you know, Grand Theft Auto and, you know, Call of Duty, as you said. But now as the parent of three gamers, I don't care at all about that. It's simply the amount of time that they're spending playing Minecraft or whatever it is, even though they're great games, but it's just there's so much time spent and I worry about what they're losing. So how do you connect those two things? I mean, I know that playing video games is very different than your therapeutic video game, but I'm sure you get this question a lot.
I do, and it's a great question, and it's a very, very real problem with just games. I mean, I think an excessive amount of anything in what it denies from other activities is an issue. Even if that is being involved in marathon running and physical exercise, and you do it at such an extreme that you don't do other things that are important. So I think that it is a very real issue. You need to moderate activities in your life just so you have room for all the great things that we should be exposed to. And if you're playing video games at the exclusion of interacting with people face to face and sleeping well, then it's a problem. And so I think that if there's any message around this, it is one of moderation.
And so did you ever feel as when you were growing up that that video games took over what you were doing, or was it easier for you to moderate?
I mean, there were times when I was deeply involved in a game that I was just with that I'm sure I played what would be considered excessive. But I don't think it was never a problem that it disrupted my life in a functional way that was an issue. At least I didn't perceive it that way, or no one ever told me that I reached that level. But it happens to people where you just go down these rabbit holes and it becomes all consuming and everything else in your life becomes secondary. I don't think I ever reached that point.
Well, I think that's what's difficult about this sometimes, as I've noticed, that self-moderation is very different in terms of just even the three children I have. Some are better at it than others. I mean, that must be something that's related to your brain, too, so that, you know, some people can say, like, I can play video games just fine and stop when I need to. Others, it's more difficult.
I mean, this is true of, you know, so many behaviors, including other addictions and dependencies that people have. Some people don't get addicted to alcohol, never would, and other people do very rapidly. And you see addiction to behaviors like internet use in general, pornography. I mean, the list goes on, technology use, social media. So, you know, it's how your brain experiences those rewards and how you manage it and how it interacts with other things in your life. But those type of, at least, you know, to avoid the word addiction, because it's such a complicated term in terms of the differences and similarities between chemical addictions and behavioral addictions. But just to say extreme use of something that you're obsessively involved in that diminishes your function in other aspects of your life, to define it that way, these type of dependencies occur across many domains. I think it's a challenge across the entire tech world.
I know we're going a little bit off topic of your specific fields of study, but it's not every day I get to talk to a neuroscientist, so I thought I'd throw those questions in.
You can go anywhere.
True. Well, that's what's so amazing when you're thinking about how you started watching Cosmos. And this morning I did an interview about space travel, and they're so similar, really. I mean, like, one is just how far can we get out there? And your study is how far can we get in there? And just the similarities are amazing.
I mean, it's true. I was, you know, when watching Cosmos, I was like, I want to be an astronomer. That was just so fascinating to me, the infinite complexity and how little we knew or understood and still do. And then I discovered all the math involved and the physics. And it was interesting, but it just didn't appeal to me the way biology started appealing to me. I just had more of a connection with people that felt that it would be better served turning my attention inwards to the brain and the mind rather than outwards to space. But I feel the same amount of excitement when I think about the universe and its expansiveness, and when you think about the expansiveness of the human mind. So that was a really good switch for me.
So tell us about NeuroRacer, the game. You developed the game, you made it, but instead of putting it out there to compete with Call of Duty 2, you decided to put it through FDA clinical trials.
Yeah, so in 2008, like we were discussing, I had the idea for the game, and I was focused on older adults because that's what I had been researching. And so we did a three-year study, we being my laboratory at UCSF, and we found that we could improve older adults' ability not just to play the game, but also their attention and their working memory. We also recorded brain activity during gameplay to understand how the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, the most evolved part of our brain, has better engagement after gameplay. And so in 2013, we published that data in Nature magazine, which is, you know, as good as it gets for us scientists. And it was the cover of the journal, so it was a super exciting point in my career and everyone on the team. And there were many, many people, including folks from LucasArts, from the game industry, who helped us build NeuroRacer. And so that was a moment in time of where do we go from here. For a lot of research projects, having it published in Nature is the end, right? I mean, there is no higher moment of reward for a research study than a publication as the cover of Nature. But I didn't want it to end as an academic exercise. That's not why NeuroRacer came into existence and this whole project was formed. I really did it to help people directly in their lives. And there's so many scientific discoveries that reach that phase where they are, you know, peer-reviewed publication, and then that's it. They just live on the academic shelves or online, in our case now, forever, and never advance to its potential of actually helping people. And so I was faced with this question, what do we do with NeuroRacer? Do we just put it out there, click to consume, like consumer video games are currently positioned, or do we do something different with it? And so the idea I had at that time was to see if we could take it to the next level as not just a approach to improve attention generally, but as an actual clinical therapeutic tool that could be used as a type of medicine. And in order to do that, I realized that I could not take the game development to the next stage within our laboratory at UCSF. This is where it had to leave the lab and become associated with a company that could build it out as a product. NeuroRacer was really a prototype. It was never a product. And so I filed a patent, which was my first foray into the world of intellectual property, to help protect the idea, the methodology behind NeuroRacer. Now, the patent's not for a game. You can't really patent that. The patent's for the game engine, how we weave together adaptivity of the challenge based on your performance in real time, and as well as real time feedback across these multiple tasks. And so that patent is owned by my university. UCSF owns that patent. I am the inventor. And I hope co-found a company in 2010 called Akili, A-K-I-L-I, Akili Interactive. And Akili is now the licensor of that technology. So that's the three-way relationship across NeuroRacer's technology. And Akili has now put together an amazing game team, including folks from LucasArts that helped build NeuroRacer and other, you know, AAA video game professionals, as well as a healthcare team to try, I can see up on the screen, Matt Ormanek is one one of the creators of NeuroRacer, and he was at LucasArts at the time. And what we've done now is the team at Achille is we've built a way better video game than NeuroRacer from all the perspectives that you want a game to be engaging and fun for people. So higher levels of art, music, story, reward, better usability using, you know, with an iPad, so you have the accelerometer and the tap screen as opposed to a, you know, really awkward joystick, which is what we used in NeuroRacer, and then using the cloud in a much more effective way to have data analytics and server support. And what we've now decided, as opposed to just putting the game out there, we are now taking the game through the highest level of regulatory approvals to try to advance it as a clinical treatment for multiple different populations that have deficits in attention. So the list is long. Post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, early Alzheimer's disease and multiple sclerosis, depression, and where we've advanced the farthest with our research is as a clinical treatment for children with ADHD.
That's the furthest you've gone with ADHD?
Yeah, the ADHD is the only research project that has now finished a phase 3 trial. So for those that are not familiar with the FDA passage of a device or a drug, there are these stages, these phases of research that get larger and more complex as you prove that what you're doing is not dangerous and has some efficacy. A phase 3 is the large multi-site randomized double-blinded study that you do for any drug or device right before you submit to the FDA to get it approved. And we completed one. It's the only research study of its kind that I'm aware of across 20 sites, 350 children with a diagnosis of ADHD, randomized, placebo-controlled, to determine if playing EVA, which is the game that came from NeuroRacer, if it would improve their attention abilities. And in at the very end of 2017, we reported positive effects on our primary outcome measure, showing that EVA, in fact, is capable of improving attention on a diagnostic test, an FDA-approved test of ADHD in children that play that game for a month, 5 days a week for 30 minutes a day. So that's what the dosage was in the study, the dosage of the video game. And we are now positioning that to the FDA to have it approved as a clinical treatment, just like stimulants are currently prescribed for ADHD, which would make it the first non-drug treatment for ADHD, the first prescribable video game, and maybe even most exciting, the first of a new category of medicine, what we think of as a digital medicine to treat a condition of the brain.
And so this, did you do tests alongside medication, or was it clearly all without medication?
So that study was done with the children on no current medications at all. They were not on stimulants. It's not that challenging or difficult to do an ADHD study under those circumstances. Our current depression trials are gameplay while they're taking antidepressants. Mm-hmm. But with stimulants, we have 2 million children across the United States who have a diagnosis of ADHD but are not treated with anything at all. Mm-hmm. They either don't want to take it, or they had bad effects, or their parents don't want them to take it. So, you know, there are a lot of kids out there. And then there's another 2 million that are taking stimulants that don't want to, or their parents don't want them to. So they're very willing to come off and try something different. So this was tested as a monotherapy, and that's what we will be seeking approval for, this as a treatment for ADHD.
So why the switch from Alzheimer's patients to ADHD patients?
Yeah, so when we started Achille and our goals were to advance this treatment as a medicine, we looked across the whole spectrum of conditions that might benefit from it. And Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia are on the list, and we are doing research on them as well. But ADHD, the need was so great. Pretty much every parent that has a child treated with a stimulant for ADHD really wants to have another option, and market testing has shown this very well. So, and we also know that children play video games already in vast numbers. And so it made sense to lead with ADHD. Although, as I said, all the other conditions I mentioned are in clinical trials also. So it's not that we favored it in some conceptual way. It just really made the most sense. We are a startup. Our path is to get one thing there through the door and then obviously follow with others. And this one was the one that was the most logical from a business perspective.
Why didn't you go through like the supplement route? Like, you know, just offering this to like parents like me who, you know, my kids don't have a diagnosis, but they, you know, they're 13-year-old boys, two of them. And, you know, it's the attention is difficult. Like, I would love something to just supplement and help them. I don't want to say it, but, you know, be less like a 13-year-old boy.
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that I thought about a lot. And I do want to say before I answer that, that, you know, at UCSF, we have many other technologies that are video games, and some of them may go that route. They may go more like the health and wellness and supplement route. Some may go more educational and into the school system. For this particular game and our first treatment and Achilles goals, what we really wanted to do was introduce a new type of medicine into the system. There's a lot of things out there, like in the, you know, nutraceutical world and a lot of supplements that doctors just won't prescribe. They haven't reached that highest level of empirical evidence and FDA approval, and they won't turn to them. And so what we wound up with is a system that's very siloed. And for 60 years, we've relied almost solely on pharmaceuticals as medicine. And medicine doesn't mean drugs, although a lot of people will say that if you ask them what medicine is. And so we felt that the only way we could introduce a new medicine into the system was essentially to play by the same rules that are currently engaged in by pharmaceutical companies, get into the system with a new medicine, and then start changing it and speeding up the approval process and the scale that we can distribute something that has very little side effects. But that was the thinking, that we really felt that the time has come for us to have a new medicine, a digital medicine, and everyone is ready for it, from the FDA to the insurance companies to the doctors to the tech industry. So that was the thinking behind it.
So what are the side effects?
Well, in our phase 3 trial, you have to record side effects. That's just part of the FDA approval process. And it's responsible. If you think that you have a treatment that is effective enough to be a medicine, then it can easily induce negative effects. And most things do, you know, in the world do have both positive and negative effects. So the most commonly reported side effect of children with ADHD in our phase 3 trial was frustration. As a matter of fact, it was the only dropout was for frustration. So the game is, it's hard. I mean, it is designed in a closed loop system, meaning that the challenge that the players experience is scaled to their ability level in real time. So that game is just like the ultimate personal trainer. Every single second, it's reading out your ability and pushing you right up to that level. And it's frustrating for everyone, especially when you almost get a reward and you just don't reach it. But for children with ADHD, it seems, you know, very frustrating. But most all of them push through that. And, you know, we do a lot of things with the gameplay to try to make it as rewarding. And despite the frustration, we still had a very, very high level of fun and enjoyment that were reported in the study. But that is the side effect.
So what do you say when people ask you, like, well, what can I do right now? Like, is there, you know, can I have prescribe myself to have my kids play Minecraft for an hour a day? Is there anything out there on the market now?
Yeah, well, you know, there is a literature showing that video game play does have benefits on cognition, but a lot of that has not been, or almost all of it hasn't been done in cognitive in clinical populations, so children with ADHD, and showing what those benefits are. And so it's really hard for me to point to existing games and recommend them for cognitive improvement. I mean, if you enjoy playing them and you moderate it as we discussed, it's, you know, reasonable given the data that it could have benefits. But it's hard for me to make strong recommendations because there's just not a ton of data across these different populations and needs. I always say, you know, and not just say, but practice as well, the things that you could do in your daily life that will help with your cognition and your attention while we work on these, you know, very sophisticated technology tools. I just remember talking with Kevin about this, Kevin Rose on his show, the 5 pillars of brain health, as I describe it and think about it. The first, because, and I I say only the first because it has the most evidence, is physical exercise, both aerobic and weight training. Tons of data, especially as we get older, that it has benefits, you know, beyond the cardiovascular benefits that are well documented, but in terms of how our brains function, and even reducing some of the detrimental effects that occur with aging. So physical exercise, cognitive exercise, cognitive challenge, that's where we're building our video games to fine tune that, but engaging in the world in a rich and dynamic and challenging way will have a benefit. We see the advantages of those type of careers and people that have more experience in the educational system on terms of how their brain functions later in life. Musical training, language exposure, things like that support this idea of cognitive challenge. And then the other three are nutrition, sleep, as well as stress management. Lots of data about those. Sleep, so important for the health of our brains. And when I say stress management, I don't mean no stress at all. Our brains respond to stress. Challenge is a type of stress. It's really that helpless stress that has been shown to damage the brain, actually, in a very structural, real way due to cortisol levels. So those five things, physical exercise, cognitive challenge, stress management, sleep, and nutrition. The challenge, of course, is the recipe. What is the perfect recipe of those to lead to the maximal health of your brain? But those are the things that you can engage in your everyday life. And probably most people know them already because those are the things that have been described that are good for our health and our body in general. But the data would lend the most support to those five things.
And what about those apps you always see that, like, you know, elevate the brain training apps? They'll do this. And, you know, and I've read that those claims are not necessarily as scientific as they could be. What do you think about those apps?
Well, I agree with you. And what you heard, you might have heard me say that at some point because I do get asked this question a lot. Look, the foundation of this entire field of that goes by many names, from brain games to cognitive training, we at Achille and Neuroscape don't really use those terms because they've become so complicated, as you describe, with overinflated marketing claims. We think of what we're doing as digital medicine, you know, and we're trying to position it in such a way. But regardless of the semantics, the entire field is built on a really solid foundation that our brains are plastic and they will modify themselves at every level. Its structure, its chemistry, its function, all in response to challenge. But that doesn't mean that every challenge is going to be equally effective and have as meaningful benefits and have the sustainable effects. And so you really have to not just base a claim on a good idea. You actually have to use the scientific process to then validate that that treatment does really have that benefit. And that's really been the disconnect. It's the use of the word science as an idea as opposed to science as a methodology, right? So saying that something is based on science is not a high bar. I mean, if it's not based on science at all, it's probably not a good idea. But what you really are trying to say is that you have now validated it with scientific methods. And that's really where science could be used as a marketing tool in, I think, a sort of dangerous and damaging way. So, you know, some of it may work or may not work, but you really have to do the research. And the research takes a long time and it's expensive. And a lot of companies might not have it in their business model to require that degree of evidence before they move a product to market. And thus you get sometimes this disconnect between marketing claims and reality.
So Silicon Valley, as you know, I'm not telling you something you don't know, moves really fast. The technology from 2008 is radically different than it is now. But you know, biomedical science does not work as move as fast. It's a little bit harder than creating the next Facebook. So, I mean, who are your investors? Where are you getting, who are you talking to try to move this forward?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting story because when I started this company with my co-founders, we were looking at Silicon Valley tech investors, and it was a really hard sell. I mean, it's now a long time ago. Things have changed, not just in terms of what we've shown, but the whole field has advanced and perception has changed. But you're right. When you go to a tech investor and say, I have this software, that's a video game, and we're looking for funding for a Series A, but we might not have a product for 5, 6, 7 years. They're like, what? Why would I invest in that? It's like completely different than so many of the other tech investments that they're looking at. When you go to a healthcare investor with that story, they're like, only 6 years? And they look at it just completely differently. So it could be really long or really fast, depending on who you talk to. And we found that most of our investments, certainly at the beginning stages, but even now, have been biased towards healthcare investors that have frequently invested in, you know, invasive medical devices or pharmaceutical companies, and including investments from pharmaceutical companies themselves, four of them, that recognize that if there is a digital revolution going on in their field, they don't want to have that, you know, Kodak moment where they realize they missed it. And so that's what has happened, that even though we are a tech company in many ways, we build software, we build video games, we are a healthcare company as well. And most of our investment is through that side.
And I mean, since 2008, there's been a lot of changes in the healthcare technology. There's a lot of big players in this field, not exactly what you're talking about, but like, you know, the Apple Watch, for example, and all of the tools that are trying, those kinds of tools that are trying to get FDA approval. Would you say those are competitors of yours, or are they sort of the rising tide that's lifting everyone in this area?
We don't view any direct competitors right now that are really trying to build this type of interactive experience as medicine itself. There we feel we are sort of leading the charge. We would love there to be many, many more companies positioning products for this type of FDA approval, but there's really none others that are like that right now. But there are a lot of other companies, not just in the brain domain, but throughout healthcare, that are looking at digital therapeutics more generally, like cognitive behavioral therapy as a mobile treatment, or sensors and assessments as clinical tools. And, you know, we are delighted that that exists. It's part of the larger ecosystem that that has to happen for us to be successful. We just can't be one company in a field. So I think we'll all play a role, and hopefully we'll all work together and help build a rich field around technology as both assessments, diagnostics, and treatments.
I'm talking to Adam Ghazali. He is a neuroscientist and the creator of what might be the first digital video game that you can prescribe to someone, a video game prescription. And I'm really interested in continuing this conversation, but I just have to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you've ever tried to get a mortgage, you know it can be difficult. It was sort of old-fashioned until Rocket Mortgage came along. They threw technology at the problem. Now you can apply simply and understand fully, and you can mortgage confidently. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's about confidence, the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds, and it's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. So Rocket Mortgage will know your income, your assets, and your credit, and they can analyze all of that. They throw their algorithms at it, and then they look at all the home loan options that you qualify for, and then they find the right one just for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. If you want to get started, all you have to do is go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. Tell us a little bit about your lab. I've seen some pictures of it and what you guys are doing. Tell us a little bit about what happens there.
Yeah, so at UCSF, I started my laboratory 13 years ago, and that's the laboratory that created NeuroRacer and has done lots of other work on multitasking and distraction, and now we have become a center called NeuroScape. So after the Nature paper, we got really enthusiastic about the broader goals of technology and the positioning of it as tools to improve how our brain functions beyond just the idea that video games can be helpful. So the other technology that's related to it, so virtual reality and motion capture and physiological senses, augmented reality, artificial intelligence, machine learning algorithms, how do all of these technologies, many of which are being born right here, blocks away from where our lab is, so it's quite appropriate from a spatial perspective as well as a time perspective. Could we use technology and with neuroscience integrated as a new approach to medicine? And so NeuroScape, which is our center, has taken that as its mission. We have five programs that we engage in. We have faculty across them that lead those programs. The first one that I'll mention is our technology program. So from NeuroRacer as our start, we have become much more aggressive at being innovative and really trying to push the envelope on how technology can play a role here. And so right across the board, we develop technologies like assessments, like evaluation to understand people's cognitive abilities while they're at home. We have a technology called Body Brain Trainer where we integrate physical and cognitive challenges to help improve your brain, both through physical fitness and cognitive fitness. We have a game called Engage, which is a mindfulness game to help improve sustained attention and delayed gratification in children and teenagers, where we'll be testing very soon. We have a game called Rhythmicity, which is a rhythm training game we built with Mickey Hart from the Grateful Dead and Rob Garza from Thievery Corporation to try to understand how rhythm can help improve timing and anticipation in the brain to lead to benefits in cognition. We have a game called Meditrain. I think people would be really interested in it. It's a game built on the principles of concentrative meditation. It was co-developed with philanthropics from Zynga, mindfulness thought leader named Jack Kornfield. This is the first of those games that I just described to you that has data now. All the rest are in research studies, but the data shows that we can improve attention abilities in young people, 20 and 30 year olds, that engage in Meditrain practice for 6 weeks. So technology development is a big part of what NeuroScape does. We're essentially an incubator of sorts. I usually design the first pass technology, then we develop them. It takes us around 2 years for like each of those technologies you heard about. And then it takes us around 2 years to do research. And so three other programs that we have are our neuroscience program, our education program, and our clinical program, where we move our technologies into research phase, where it might focus on healthy young adults, where we might think of it as an aspect of education, or we might have it in clinical programs, as you've already heard about, looking at how it might be a new approach to medicine, and then looking at it across the entire age, you know, lifespan, where it could be a wellness approach.
So none of these are available to consumers at this point?
Now, all of these games are now in research studies, but as we gain data and publish papers like where we're up to with Meditrain, they'll move out of the lab either to Achille or another company. They all have patents associated with them to help protect that the ideas behind them and make them attractive for companies to bring them to the next level. And as I described earlier, some of them may go the healthcare route and become new digital medicines. Others may become more on the wellness side and be available to everyone without prescription. And some may go into the school system. So their future is still unknown. right now we're trying to do the research. We do brain recordings during gameplay, and now we look at stress and mood in addition to cognition. We do blood work looking at inflammatory markers and hormone levels. Anything that we think can change in response to the game, we pretty much record before, sometimes during, and then after. And once we get enough evidence that we have something real here and something that's important and that's sustainable and its benefits, then we move it out of NeuroScape. So far only one has left our doors so far.
I've definitely heard of VR being used to help with PTSD, or, you know, there are all kinds of other things that people, you often hear people when they're trying to defend it. It's not just for video games. Is that happening now? Like, are therapists using it just even though there's no FDA approval of any of that?
It's starting to happen in some domains. So the areas where I've seen VR play the biggest role therapeutically has been on pain management, where there has been some research showing, like for example, during burn victims' bandage removal, an incredibly painful experience. It can be used, and the studies seem to suggest that even at the level of morphine, to help minimize pain during those procedures. It's been used for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder as like an exposure therapy. I have colleagues that are using it in hospitals just for patients that are in wards for very long periods of time. You know, there's not a lot to look at. They're not the cheeriest of environments. So to have a technology that allows you to leave that space and travel somewhere beautiful seems to have a lot of benefit. But like you said, there's still a lot of data that we need to move these into the clinical system more broadly. We have two virtual reality video games that we are currently building right now. One is called Virtual Attention, where you're in this bathysphere under the ocean collecting species of fish and tagging them. And it's an attention game that we think will help you deploy your attention more effectively. And we have another game called Labyrinth, where you navigate in a 3D cityscape. So you walk around on an omnidirectional treadmill. We're also using trackers for that now. And the goal there is to increase your ability to navigate spatially, not just so that you don't get lost, you know, on your way to work or in other places, but because we hypothesize that if we improve your spatial navigation in this type of immersive environment, it will lead to benefits in other aspects of your memory. So that's what we're always trying to do with all of our technologies, but especially with virtual reality, because of the immersion, is to lead to better transfer outside of gameplay into skills that you'll need in your daily lives.
So you founded a company, you're managing the company, managing the clinical trials, managing a lab, I'm assuming lots of graduate students. How much time do you have to actually do research yourself?
Sorry, I missed the end of that. Yeah, so we have a whole giant team here. I'm involved as a director. I design a lot of the experiments. I always read through all the papers and help analyze or interpret the data. But we have, you know, faculty members here. We have, you know, hordes of postdocs and research associates and, as you said, students. And so we have a large team all accounted for. There's 120 people here at NeuroScape. So we have a lot of research being done all of the time, and I'm very involved, but I don't do the day-to-day data collection. So that allows me to do other things. I do a lot of public speaking. I have a venture fund called Jazz Venture Partners that I am a partner in, where we invest in other technology companies that are building tools for human performance improvement. I'm in the process of starting another company. I'm also related to virtual reality and wellness. So, you know, it's great that I have such a high performing team in all of these entities that allow me to, spread my interest more broadly.
Well, I mean, since you're in brain optimization, then you'd have to be doing all this, because people would ask, like, why aren't you doing more since you know how the brain works? So let's spend some time talking about multitasking. It's bad, we know. But is any multitasking good at all? Because I feel like I can't get through the day without multitasking, which mainly means like listening to podcasts at all hours of the day when I'm doing other stuff.
Yeah, so I don't think of multitasking as bad or good. I think that it will, we have lots of data showing that if you engage in more than one task or even multiple information streams coming in, you'll have a degradation in your performance. So if these tasks are attention demanding, the networks of the brain cannot parallel process them. They will have to switch. And with each switch of these networks, there's a degradation of the signal, a loss of some of the fidelity, and that results in a slower performance, loss of accuracy. Depending on what you're doing, you might not notice it. And that depends on how time pressured the things that you're doing are. It doesn't mean that it's bad inherently. It just means that you have to make an informed decision based upon how your brain works when you decide to engage in it. So I think everyone pretty much knows now that driving a car and looking down in your lap and texting is a bad idea. I mean, we probably always should have intuitively known that. But, that's like a very high risk situation to have less than full attention on the road. So that one, I think we've wrapped our heads around. But, there are so many other domains of your life where it may not feel as impactful, but it's still going to take a performance you're still going to take a performance hit when you divide your attention. So when I am working on something that's time sensitive, that has like my signature associated with it, that I really want to do at the highest level and that requires attention, I will quit all of my other information sources and really focus on one thing. Take breaks because I think that's really important, but learn how to engage in something in a sustained way. But at other times when I'm doing things that are not that critical, maybe don't demand that much attention, that are not fun, as you described, multitasking has a higher novelty load. So in general, it's more fun to multitask than to single task. Then I'll multitask away. But I will, literally on my calendar block out times that I'm going to focus on one thing and allow times where I'll listen to music, switch over to Facebook if I'm bored, and multitask.
Okay. So yeah, mainly it's podcasts while I'm folding the laundry.
I think that's really smart because you're maximizing your time. Folding laundry has a really low attentional demand. It's well practiced. It's almost questionably not multitasking if it really becomes completely rote. That's a really good example of where you get that benefit of doing more than one thing. But there's lots of other examples you could think of where it's less advised.
I happen to notice that you're not on Twitter very often. You're a every other day-ish tweeter, not a lot of replies. And I take that as a sign that maybe spending the better part of the day on Twitter is not the best use of your time and maybe others' time.
Yeah, I use social media. I would say I use Facebook the most. I have my community, mostly friends and extended friends that I'll share with, but still not every day by any means. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram less frequently, although I do go on them. I find it distracting a lot. I think they're valuable in a lot of ways, but I do not go on them as often as others.
And what about the Apple Watch? I mean, my idea of having this was, well, then I won't look at my phone that often. I'll just have it. But I'm not that good at controlling my notifications. And, I'll go in and, every time you download another app, it'll ask you again and you just click through. So I end up getting notified. I probably have different email apps that I've tried and they all notify me. What is exactly is happening in my brain when I'm trying to focus and I get that tap on my wrist?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, I have an Apple Watch as well, but I tend to turn off all notifications. As a matter of fact, I have all notifications off. Sometimes I'll keep text on because I don't get all that many, and usually when I do, I actually want to know about it. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we know that distractions, and this is a perfect example of a distraction, also diminish your performance. So I break interference into two different parts in the research that we do. One is multitasking, where you make the decision about engaging in more than one task at a time. There is no doubt that that type of activity will degrade performance across both of those tasks. The other type of interference is distraction. It's when you are choosing to focus on one thing, a conversation right now, and then there's irrelevant information, information that you are actually determined to ignore, like your watch buzzing on your hand or your phone in your pocket or a conversation at the cubicle next to you, and you're trying to shut it out. It's not multitasking. We're single tasking right now, but even that type of interference also degrades performance. We do not have a completely effective filter, and that filter gets worse as we get older. A lot of my earlier research showed that older adults are actually focusing on what they want to in a very comparable way to a 20-year-old, where they're having their challenge is filtering out the irrelevant information that they're trying to ignore. So I think just as important as it is to make decisions about when you single task and when you multitask, it's also really important to diminish distracting irrelevant information that will interfere with your performance when you are trying to do something that's important to you.
And it's become in fashion to turn your iPhone black and white. What is happening in the brain there? Is that less making it less appealing to us and perhaps cutting down on our use of it?
I think so. I'm not quite sure about that. I think that anything that you can do to make it less juicy in some ways and demanding of your attention is probably a positive. And I assume that's what turning it black and white helps do, that you're like, oh, it's not so much fun to look at anymore. But, these are all, whether it's putting, I know people that will put their phone in their bag, in their trunk when they drive because they cannot resist pulling it out at a light, no matter how much they try. And then the next thing they know, they're using it while they're actually driving. And so, whether it's keeping your phone out of the bedroom when you go to sleep because it's a distractor or you don't want to look at it first thing in the morning, or changing the color on your phone or turning off notifications. These are all behavioral modifications that people do to help control their use of technology. And I think they're all great. It's an important thing to not be controlled by your tech, but rather to have control of how you engage with it. It's just a healthier way of living it from my point of view. And so when I'm always giving people advice about managing this incredibly information-dense world that we live in the context of us having a distracted mind, one thing is dealing with modifying our behaviors so that we're better able to engage. And the other is what I spend most of my life doing is actually strengthening our brains so that when we're forced to deal with lots of information, which happens all the time, you'll do so more effectively.
So besides those six pillars of health, nutrition, exercise, sleep, the other important things, is there anything we can do to strengthen our attention span, strengthen our brain, like any little hacks you have for us?
I think it's really those things. Maybe I'll give one. I'm trying to reach for one more. A lot of it is really about awareness, too. Recognizing that we are distractible. And that when we do multiple things, there is a performance decrement. The listeners right now could, whether they want to be honest to other people or not, be honest to themselves and say, have you ever had a conference call and tried to work on your email at the same time? Maybe they have. Most people probably have. And when you do something like that, you feel the burden. You know that you're not really capable of doing both of those at the level that you want to be. But other things sort of go without your notice because they're not quite as much pressure on both of those systems. So I would say that keeping an awareness of how your brain performs at a high level and when it's being challenged, like really improving your metacognition, will help with your attention, because you'll start pausing when someone actually tells you their name at a party and realize that if you don't pay attention, you will definitely not remember their name and have to ask again at another time. When you get out of your car in a parking lot, like actually pausing and saying, I'm on level 5. These type of just being aware of your brain and how it functions effectively and how it struggles will help.
Well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like so many of the interviews I do are about technology killing us or ruining our children, ruining our relationships. And it's so good to know that there's really hope that we could use it for good. I'm so excited about your FDA trials. I can't, I understand I'm going to wait. I have to be patient like a scientist, not like a tech person. But, but thank you so much. Dr. Adam Ghazali is a neuroscientist. He is an MD. He's at UCSF. And he is, runs a company, Achille Interactive. Check it out. And also the executive director of Neuroscape. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun talking with you.
Thanks so much. Is there anything else that we need to point people to if they want to learn more?
No, I think that'll do it. That's where they could follow me.
All right. Well, thank you. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation records every week at 3 p.m. Pacific. And it's hosted by myself, Megan Maroney, also Leo Laporte, Jason Howell, and Father Robert Balasar. And you can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/try. We'd love for you to subscribe. You can also watch live at 3 p.m. Pacific on Fridays and chat with us at irc.twit.tv. We'll see you next week.